Good afternoon. We will open the House Committee on Revenue. It's Tuesday, the 29th of March, 2005, and we are just a minute or two after the starting hour. I apologize for getting started late. Our schedule is full today. We have a number of bills to upon which to hold public hearings, and at this time, we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 3355. Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 3355, this is an investment tax credit bill. And so basically what this is doing, it creates a personal income or corporate excise tax credit for new investments in machinery and equipment. Specifies that the investment tax credit equal percent, that is a blank in the bill, of the total certified amount of qualified investments made by the taxpayer during the tax year. It's limiting the tax credit to the lesser of a fixed amount, that is again a blank in the bill, or the tax liability of the taxpayer. It requires businesses to apply with the Department of Revenue to certify the new investments by stating the date of purchase of the equipment as well as the value of the qualified investment. It's limiting the amount, then, total amount of certified investment tax credit to $30 million per biennium. It allows a four-year carry-forward for this investment tax credit. It provides a non-resident or part-year taxpayer with a prorated investment tax credit, and it requires the amount of the tax credit to be reduced from the adjusted basis of new machinery and equipment that has claimed a deduction for depreciation of this equipment. It applies to tax years on or after January 1st, 2006. It allows the Department of Revenue to certify the qualified investments which are purchased on or after July 1st of 2005. So it begins July 1st, 2005, so those purchases, they would all come in then in tax year 2006. It sunsets the investment tax credit for qualified investments on July 1st, 2011. So basically, under current law, Oregon does not have a broad-based investment tax credit. We do have things like those e-commerce zones in which the new investments there get a property tax exemption as well as the corporate tax credit. So this would be a new tax credit. There are only 12 states or 26% of all the states with personal income and corporate excise taxes which do not have a business investment tax credit. So a lot of states do have this. Now, just so everyone's clear, since we do have blanks in the bill, I was asked to just try to start looking at what are some different options and how quickly we would get to this cap of the $30 million per biennium. So I've given you a table here of basically the preliminary some revenue loss estimates from the investment tax credit. So it's setting it at a 2.5% of qualified investments plus a $2,500 annual cap per employer. That basically would result in this first biennium a loss of $16 million. Now, most of it is in the corporate tax revenues, but also you've got the other pass-through entities, the LLCs, the S-corporations, the partnerships. So so that $16 million is primarily $14.6 million of that is corporate tax revenue loss.
So I could get that pretty evenly split to 90-10 throughout.
Yeah, yeah. It's about 80-20 as far as just the, as far as I was looking at the total new investments in equipment as 80% going to C corporations and then the other 20% being the other smaller businesses. So basically, what you have to take into consideration again is that carry forward as well as the use of that credit over time. So that's why it's growing per biennium. And then you see there in 07-09 is when we first, for this 2.5% of qualified investments plus $2,500, you would first hit that $30 million limit. So then if you drop down and you only had a limit of $1,000 per year, then you wouldn't hit that $30 million limit until the next biennium, the 2009-11 biennium, where then there would have to be some limiting. So there would have to be, from the Department of Revenue, some kind of a waiting list, some kind of a, you know, rule made in order to kind of describe how you would be allowing corporations to come on and use this credit over time. And then as you go down, you could drop it from a 2.5% of qualified investments to 1% of qualified investments. Then that reduces the revenue impact in 06-07 to about $10.6 million, and then you don't, again, hit the $30 million until the 2009-11 buy-in, and then you would hit that $30 million limit. If you went down to 1% of qualified investment plus just a $1,000 annual limit, then you wouldn't hit it in either one of these next two bienniums, in the 2007-09 buy-in or the 2009-11 biennium.
Is there a mechanism in place that the Department of Revenue could basically ration out $30 million maximum? How does the rationing of a credit work?
Chairman Butler, this bill really doesn't specify, any rules or guidance for them, so it would really be up to them as far as deciding, how many probably new credits they're allowing, because they do have a certification mechanism in the bill. So I would imagine they would stop certifying if they've already hit $30 million and first-come, first-served basis. I would think that would be the way they would go. But, again, the bill's kind of silent on that. If that's something that you want, from a policy perspective, want to add a language in that area, that would probably be helpful.
You don't think we ought to do it alphabetically or something like that, beginning with the A's and B's or something.
So if there's other, I can do a variety of runs. It's just I just started setting some limits that give you an idea of how much you would get in revenue loss per biennium, just given some different, these are low threshold amounts. Obviously, if you increase either the percentage or the annual cap, you would hit the $30 million sooner, and then it would just be a question of allocating them and, how many different corporations we're going to be waiting. The other idea to consider is this is just new investments, but it is across the board. It's every sector that would have new investments, so, everyone who bought a new computer or whatever could use this. But you could think about limiting it, targeting it, certain sectors, if that was, of interest to you. And so that's another way you could lower the revenue impact.
The adjusted basis of new equipment and the definition of new equipment, is that new from the dealer? Is that what that is?
Yes, it said it's being new manufactured. It's
okay.
Kind of the first part of it.
And it can be manufactured in any country?
Yeah, it does. Oh, and the other thing is, Chairman Butler, I haven't, these are static numbers. So we haven't run this in the Oregon tax incident model yet with the feedback effects. So that would be the next step, is to bring this bill back as well as these research and development credit bills that you have today. I didn't do a static impact for those yet, but we could do all those together and then just look at some of these dynamic feedback effects for these different proposals, and then you can see the overall impact.
Okay. Any questions of staff? So, colleagues, this is a concept which has been around for considerable time, has proven very, very effective in spurring on rather significant increases in investments in new or used property, plant, and equipment. In this case, it is newly manufactured, never before used for any purpose. So this would enhance the purchase of new manufacturing equipment, new equipment in the various businesses. We have Lynn Lundquist and J.L. Wilson, Oregon Business Association and NFIB. Let's have Don Schellenberg come up too, I guess. I can't spell it. He's going to speak in opposition, as is J.L. Wilson, against the alphabetical ordering of the...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. First of all, I thank you for sponsoring this bill and for helping us move this concept into at least to where we can have a dialogue about that. Just very briefly, the Oregon Business Association is a statewide business association that represents businesses from all sectors. Certainly, we have tried to maintain a position of trying to have a balanced approach through good fiscal policies and also essential services that meet the needs of from Oregon as a whole. We try to take that holistic approach. I think the first question I'd like to answer is why should we look at an investment tax credit at this particular time? Well, the economy, as we all know, has had its real difficulties. It is starting to grow a little bit. But there also are, I think, regardless of which economists you talk to, that yes, we are in a growth period. We're not in a dynamic growth period. Anything that we could do to help spur the economy, I believe, is good policy and good for Oregonians. As Oregon Business Association, we certainly know the relationship between a healthy economy and the ability to have revenues to meet essential services, whether it's education or human resources or public safety, whatever it might be. So even though we have started to climb just a little bit, I still think the time is very applicable to try to insert investment tax credit into the mix to keep us going. We all buy gas every too often, I suppose, and we know what that is going to do to the economy as well. So this would be the exact opposite of that, to try to stimulate it. There is some discussion by some people might have of why look at investment tax credit instead of a capital gains tax cut or income tax cut. We certainly do not oppose any of those. But the reason we brought this one forward at this time is because the tax incidence model that Elizabeth will talk about, I think, in the next, whenever you hold a hearing on this meeting, on this bill again, will show that of the three, it's the most surgical, if you will, of the types of credits that can be given to spur the economy on. And as she indicated, we have proposed in this bill that it's a three biennium sunset on that. It's not an ongoing tax credit. Again, it's surgical. It's for the time that right now, when times are not the best, to try to stimulate the economy. I think Elizabeth's done a great job of explaining the bill. As she indicated, it's new machinery and equipment. We narrowed the bill down. The one we used to have at the federal level had used equipment as well as structures, if I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman. You remember that probably better than I do.
Certain types of horticultural structures were included under the federal credit.
So we've tried to narrow it down a little bit to lessen the total impact. The percent, as Elizabeth has talked about, is 2.5 or 1, and I think that's up for debate. It's what certainly the committee would like to do, and that's why we left it blank in that arena. In general, Oregon Business Association tends to favor to keep the rate as high as possible and limit the total dollars so that you actually stimulate someone to actually make that additional investment and not just an investment that they're already making. We also, as was indicated, you could narrow this down by sector. Basically, it's been our belief, and certainly would work with the chairman and the committee about this, belief or prejudice at this time is that the broader you keep this, the more good it does across Main Street, if you will, of the towns and rural areas of Oregon, that you let everyone participate to some degree. And in doing that, I tried to portray this bill as a fact that this is good for small business, and it's not necessarily the type of bill that Nike, who is one of our members of the Fortune 500 company, will be particularly interested in. Sure, they'll take whatever they can get out of it, but this is not designed for that. This is designed to stimulate small businesses throughout the state. I could have brought some information in regard to the taxing schedules and all that. You've seen that before in other presentations. Our point here is simply to say we're looking at something that can stimulate the Oregon's economy when it needs, when we need it right now. It doesn't go on forever. It's one that you can, what you would say, have another look at in 3 years, so that it's not that we're not locked into some ongoing program. And it seems to me this makes a lot of good business sense for the small businesses of this state to have that kind of an opportunity. Who supports this bill? Well, obviously, the business community, I think, would support the bill. But as we look at the political process, I'm actually rather proud of the fact that as we tried to work this bill around, and most of you have seen this, have been in your office, the Republicans typically will support this kind of measure. I mean, we all know how that works. But I'm proud to say that in the House, we have seven House Democrats have signed on to the bill, as well as six Senate Democrats have signed on to the bill, just simply portraying that this has a broader support than simply just a self-serving business kind of interest. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be pleased to answer any questions or turn it over to the other participants here.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Questions, Mr. Lundquist, Representative Galician.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm one of the Democrats that signed on because I see this, the idea of it being more surgical as compared to some of the other bills that we have before this committee. My question is, Chair Butler had talked about, he used the term rationing in terms of how you prioritize, you know, who gets this. Have you looked at other states and the way they do it, or do you have suggestions for how that can be done that would be most, you know, give the most sort of value-added impact?
Chairman Butler, Representative Galizio, I have not done a research of all of other states to say exactly how that happens. In this bill, as I understand it, and staff could correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think the rationing would be then they could carry over. So those that don't participate in 1 year would be able to carry over. Is that the Department of Revenue, I would think, would set those rules and regulations. So I don't have a good, solid answer for you. I think there's a way to do that. I'm sure the chairman would like to do it alphabetical, and I'm halfway in the middle, so that's all right with me as well, but that may not be the best way. But I think those are just details that can be worked out.
Representative, thank you. And the bill does provide that, of course, the Department of Revenue, in Section 2, Paragraph 3, on line 16 on the first page, that you go through the certification process, and the application shall state, down in lines 18, 19, and 20, the date of the purchase, the amount of the qualified investment, and number 3, any other information that the department would require. So I'm going to guess that the rationing is probably on a first-come, first-served basis, because the department would have the forms approving these, amount by amount until such time as they got to the upper limit. So I'm going to guess that's how that would, it could sort out. We need to make sure that mechanism is in place and we know how it's going to work. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say, first of all, Chuck Riley Consulting likes the alphabetic, but other than that, I like this bill because of the nature of the way that it actually targets. I think it's a great targeting bill, I'm not signed on to it. I think I should have, but I'm not. And I appreciate him coming.
Thank you, Representative Wright. Representative Comp is recognized.
Mr. Lundquist, I just had a question. I don't know if you've had a chance to see Elizabeth's different runs and breakdowns that she did at the different percentage rates. Would you have a recommendation what you think would serve the best impetus for economic stimulus?
Chair Butler and Representative Klump, I just saw those about
same
the time you did.
And
so I don't have any direct, except that just in general, as I stated, I think from a stimulus standpoint, the higher the rate, what the 2.5 versus
right.
1, for example, the higher the rate, the more stimulus there is to make that kind of new investment. So that's how I'd like to target that. I think this is a study and work here that we need to look at that, and I'd certainly yield to the chair for what his desires are.
Okay. A second.
Follow up, Ripley.
Thank you. But is it logical to proceed with the idea, because I was going where you're going, Mr. Lundquist, with the 2.5, but in order to broaden the opportunity would put it at the plus 1,000 annual limit versus the 2,500.
Mm-hmm. Chairman Butler, Representative Comp, again, I we want to keep it broad.
Right.
And we need to work with those figures to see where that balance is.
Okay.
And that's simply where I would like to go with that. I have designed, we've tried to design this so that the businesses across the state most have an opportunity to participate in this, because I think that makes good policy.
Right. Because that would be my guiding thought there, is that we open the most opportunity possible.
This is really targeted at a smaller business, as Mr. Lundquist says.
Mm-hmm.
The not a lot of Nikes or Intels are going to come in and sign up for a $2,500. They'll sign up for it, I'm sure. But the question is, the question at that particular point is that if the upper limit is $1,000. And the total amount is $30 million, then you've got a lot of taxpayers that are involved in it. So it certainly is targeted small end. I guess the question I would have would be the industry sector, do we have any feel for industry sectors that could be targeted that would be better served in the small end to encourage investments in that property or that plant type of equipment. Len, do you know?
Well, Chairman Butler, I did talk to Paul Lawrence before the meeting a little bit about that idea. And there are some options available. For example, if you want to target an industry that has higher wage rates, that impact could be different than if you target an industry with lower wage rates. I'm not sure, again, how that trade-off would be in trying to keep it broad. And how you define that. I think there's some things we need to look at in that regard. If you want to narrow the bill down on that, we tend to want to keep it as broad as we can.
You bet.
Because of the.
But it could be very narrowly targeted. You could run it to restaurant and beverage organizations only to try and compensate for an unusually high minimum wage, for instance. And give a credit to, in effect, for those folks to expand their businesses too. So,
Chairman Butler, we could, I suppose, target it for those businesses in Ontario. That
I don't know. That's pretty narrow. Other questions right now of Mr. Lundquist? Thank you very much, JL.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, J.O. Wilson with NFIB. I have 12,000 members here in Oregon. We argue very passionately for things like, at the federal level, increased Section 179 expensing. We argued very passionately for the accelerated bonus depreciation at the federal level and tying it here statewide. I think that was during the 2002 special session. But the reason we did that is the same reason we support House Bill 3355, is because when you invest in machinery and capital in your business, it often translates into expansion and job gain. And I can tell from our own family radio stations, we did take advantage of the bonus depreciation that was granted federally, and we attached to statewide. Our stations broadcast in Josephine County. We got a translator to help us pump in to Jackson County a little bit, expanded our audience, and subsequently it created a base from which to hire to solicit more advertising from a larger listening audience and increase our revenue, and that tends to perpetuate itself, and you get job growth as a result. And that's just our small family radio station. So our firsthand experience with something like this in light of a investment tax credit or depreciation or increased expensing, where you get to put that money into actual equipment, has been very beneficial for us. And I think if it benefits a 16-employee company out of Grants Pass, Oregon that does radio, then it has potential elsewhere too. And we support the bill.
Thank you, JL. JL, just one question. Let me, as I look at the schedule, and you've got a copy of the estimated expense or the estimated amounts at the various percentages. If the tax credit was 1% with an upper limit of $1,000, that'd be 100 G's to put into new equipment. Is that what is it? What is it typically? What's the radio station equipment on a new radio station equipment going
to
be?
Well, in that translator, you're looking at $10,000 to $12,000. My advice to you, I would front load it. At least I would front load the provisions of this bill, as Lynn suggested, and make the 2.5%. I'd up the limit and front load it because, 1% or $1,000 on that $10,000 piece of equipment, probably, a marginal incentive at best. So that's why I'd be inclined to front load it.
And I guess that's my concern is that small businesses may be able to make an investment of $10,000 or $15,000, at even at 2%, that's $250 on $10,000. That certainly is worth going through the paperwork, but my concern is it going to give you the job stimulus that you really need in whatever sector you're trying to get? So that's why I ask if you got the translator equipment and those kinds of things. Even if you put $50,000 in at 2.5%, then you're close to there. You're beyond the $1,000 credit upper limit. So I'm just anxious that we come up with a number. Representative Hass is recognized.
Thank you. I'm generally supportive of this idea, but Jill, in your case, you made that investment without an incentive.
Right. Well, Chair Butler, Representative Hass, we made that investment was made in light of the bonus depreciation that was granted federally and we attached to statewide. So there was clear incentive, not this particular incentive, but there was one in place to make that. I would also say that the expensing limit was increased from $25,000 to $100,000 just prior to that as well. So there were some pretty juicy incentives, not an investment tax credit, mind you, but there were incentives in place.
Thank you, JL. And I would say this, that I have, through the years, made rather significant decisions, business decisions, based upon the amount of the investment tax credit, whether it was 5% or 7.5% or 7% or 10%. So it is something upon which you would decide to expand or not expand your business. It basically assists with the down payment, if you will, if you know that you're going to get some immediate tax benefit from it to expand that and hire people. Okay, let's see. We do have Dave Hunt here. And Dave, can we just have you come forward, and we'll just have JL step back out of the center there if we could. Well, they're going to be a half hour. Okay, Don, do you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Not to appear selfish, but I agree with your scope of doing it alphabetically, and we start with agriculture, and we front-load it, as you indicated, at a 10% level. I say that out of history. And, Mr. Chairman, you may remember this. And I'm going to give away my age a little bit here, but back in the 60s when I was farming full-time, there was a 10% investment credit. And, boy, we did everything we could farming to figure out a way to take advantage of that 10% investment credit. And what we did, don't remember for sure, we may even have borrowed money to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I only use that illustration to show the incentive that an appropriate investment credit does provide. And for agriculture, it's usually not, it's more you're catching up. You've waited a long time, you've put off buying that piece of equipment that needed to be replaced, and finally this comes along, you've got that incentive, and it makes good sense to do it at that point. In farm country, so it makes good horse sense. And so you do that and you take advantage of it, but as was indicated, it has to be enough of incentive in order to convince you to do it. You don't do it without thinking about it, certainly. So the Oregon Farm Bureau policy clearly supports the concept of investment tax credits. We think that's good policy. It stimulates the economy. And of course, it has that ripple effect. Thinking of the agriculture community again, you buy that combine, and combines, by the way, are $100,000.
now for a new combine. So, you know, it makes quite a bit of difference. But you buy whatever it is, and then that dealer, there's more of a demand now because you have this incentive. So then he begins expanding because he has to keep his inventory up. And so it just ripples throughout the economy. And so the Farm Bureau, again, would wholeheartedly endorse the concept here. Don't know about the particulars. You heard my suggestion, and we'd be happy with that, but we'd be, I think, happy with whatever the committee decides to do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Don. Don, do you have a copy of the bill in front of you? Line?
I do not. Well, now I do, Mr. Chairman.
Page,
thank
face
you.
Page there on lines 7, 8, and 9.
First page?
Yes, on the face page, first page, mm-hmm. Section 2. Installed or used in a facility located in the estate, so that'd be on the farm. Used in a trader business, and that's to produce income. There's always a question whether or not farms are a produce income or not under this environment. I'm really anxious about line 7. Newly manufactured, never before used in a trader business. How do you define a bull or a cow there?
Good question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I just checking. I assume you'd want to. You talk about horse sense here. And
yeah.
I wondered whether you were going to define a new horse versus a used horse.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it falls under the definition of equipment. There may be certain things that do, but I'm not sure an animal does.
Used to under the 1962 Act with the investment tax credit, the bull or the cow was machinery equipment. They qualified for investment tax credit because you were producing income from them. So, I just and horses did too. So there was just a question of how you do that. So,
thank you for that history, Mr. Chairman.
Well,
I knew you'd have it.
I'm anxious about the issues that we get into ag, particularly with regard to animals, and we may want to just avoid that entirely at this particular point. I don't want to disagree.
We got in trouble with that once before,
yep,
Mr. Chairman.
Yep, we've been there, done that, got the T-shirt. So, okay.
Thank you.
Questions of Mr. Schoenberg? Yes, Representative Boquist.
I have another question for maybe more for Lynn. I mean, you threw out the 10% figure. What do you think of that figure?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Boquist, I believe, again, on the front loading, as they've talked about here, because, as I said, I want that stimulus there to do that. And if we control this, I think will have some impact, but if you control the dollar amount per taxpayer, that's where your major control, if I follow this correctly, will be. And so you can front load it and still, it takes simply a smaller investment to get there, but there'd be more stimulus for a person to make that new investment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir.
I believe it was... We oscillated between 7 and 10%. I think the last time this was in effect, wasn't it, or something?
Yeah, I think we ended up at 7% is where the investment tax credit was. I may have it mixed up with the number of years because we did drop to a 7-year life as we were trying to phase into the different kinds of depreciation codes too.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, one more comment, if I might. The carry-forward issue is very important in agriculture. As you indicated, sometimes it's difficult to make a profit 1 year, but you make it the next year, and you need that carry-forward in order to be able to take advantage of it.
Well, and this is a 4-year carryover, if I read correctly over at the top of page 2, then. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Let's see. Representative Hunt? Lynn, why don't you just pen here for just a minute? Let's talk about this some more, but I do want to hear Representative Hunt. Thank you, Representative Hunt. Welcome, and we're honored to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. Just really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Mr. Chair, and the Oregon Business Association as well. I think this is one of those, as we look at a whole variety of proposed ways to target assistance to businesses, In Oregon, I think this is one of those that clearly rises to the top because, for many of the reasons that have already been outlined today, because it would be front-loaded, because it has a special benefit for smaller businesses if it's targeted right, and because it is focused on reinvesting in Oregon. So I will spare you all the singing of the praises of the specifics of the bill because I think those have been effectively made by my predecessors on the panel. The one other thing I would encourage you all to do in this process both because I think it's the right thing to do, but also in terms of just making sure that this actually occurs and doesn't die at some point in the legislative process in this building, is find some way to pay for it, to make this revenue neutral, so we don't get caught in some debate in the building between a very worthy investment tax credit and the whole debate about, well, that's going to come out of the pocket of schools or health care or public safety or something else. I think we've got great opportunities this session to do this and other tax changes that will benefit businesses. But I would really encourage you, Mr. Chair, and members of this committee to find ways that we can actually pay for those from within existing corporate resources, to recognize that things like this are a high priority and we should do them. But if, in fact, they are a high priority, we should also find ways to pay for it.
Thank you very much, Representative Hunt. Questions for Representative Hunt? Thank you. Representative Galizio.
Just take what you just said. You know, as a freshman, I would look to my more senior members. How can we pay for this?
Well, I think the more senior members are people like Chair Butler and former Representative Lindquist here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio. I think, and for instance, on this particular issue, there is a bill that is, I believe, been assigned to your committee already, that would couple this, and it has a musical accompaniment to that measure as well, that would couple this very tax credit, the capital gains tax cut, and would pay for both by a corporate minimum increase. That's not the only way to do it. That would be one way to do it. That would actually kind of avoid the whole debate about, are we taking money from schools or not. I would say we've got, in the case of that bill, two particular things that we should do: cut capital gains taxes, invest in a capital investment tax credit, and they're so important that we're going to pay for them.
Representative, please follow up.
Follow up to this for Lynn. What do you think of that idea?
Chairman Butler, Representative Galizio, we've been on record, Oregon Business Association, of saying, even in the last session, that, you know, if there are essential services, then we will step up and do our fair share of helping support those. The minimum corporate, I've talked to the chair about this, and I know that's not his priority for sure. I will tell you this, that I have looked at, we have a bill that we did put in this time for minimum corporate, which is just simply the one you had last time. The revenue office is running some changes in that. The idea being that we've come up with is to, okay, on the minimum corporate tax, to take a certain level and say nobody pays anymore, just $10. And so put the sales at, and the first one I saw was $25,000. It might need to be higher than that, so that you take away all of those who have corporations that basically are not in the business of making money, okay? So they pay the $10 minimum corporate. And so they would not change. They would not change. So put, but then on the upper level, put them at some level of sales. You know, step it up, 100,000, 200,000, up to a million. And I'd certainly be willing to work on that kind of endeavor. So we're not opposed to that. But I also want to say that I hope the committee understands that this is only the total impact without any benefit from the program. And so the OTIM, the Oregon Tax Incentive Model, is going to come back and tell us that. And I'm waiting with bated breath, so to speak, to see what that happens. So I think we need to keep all the scenes in perspective, and that can all be on the table.
Thank you for the questions. Thank you, Representative Hunt. Again, you've honored us by being here and taking time out of your busy schedule. Thank you again. And thank you for your support of this bill. JL, I didn't mean to. Let's see, is he still here? He's booted out entirely.
Thank you for his feelings.
Yeah, I did hurt his feelings.
He won't be devastated.
No, he's gone. Okay. Well, I guess
Wilson's the end of the alphabet.
Yeah, Wilson. so much for that.
Just for the record, Mr. I did like the alphabet thing, too.
Yeah, I was hoping that both West and Berger would go along with that suggestion.
Riley Consulting.
and the Chuck.
There you go.
Chucks.
Chuck Consulting.
I'd like to explore this idea further, particularly with regard to the potential of targeting industry sectors, and with regard to some work with the Department of Revenue as to how the credit would be monitored at that level. I know that we have other credits that are applied for through the Department of Revenue. energy credits and those kinds of things.
Pollution control is.
But it's there is the energy savings. What is it? Isn't there an energy savings that they ask? There's an actual certificate issued by some department somewhere in the state of Oregon. Some efficiency credit, I thought. It isn't the Department of Revenue. Okay. Which department is it? Is that
DEQ, there's some. Energy Department, there's some other. Yeah.
Well, there must be a model then that we use then at the Department of Revenue, because this is administered by the Department of Revenue.
Right, so that's correct.
They don't issue any credits under a rationing basis.
Yeah.
So it's not an unknown concept. I guess I'm just anxious that credit be figured out. But then the credits, the limits, the industry sectors, and then the sizes. Obviously, if you got a 1% and a $1,000 limit, then the sizes that you're going to be... I'm going to guess that if you did that, to get the $30 million, you've got $3 billion worth of investment at 1%, don't you, to get the $30 million?
Yeah, and Chairman Butler, all you're doing is creating more of a carry forward than in future years as you increase that percentage. So, I mean, like they were talking about, if you were to go to 10% or something.
Right,
like, yeah.
But if you stayed at 1%, you're talking about multi-billion dollars of investment if that was what you were after, an upper limit there. My concern is the size of business that would apply for that probably would never get to $30 million in a biennium.
If you only had 1%.
If you only had 1% with a $1,000 upper limit, folks would not apply to it. JL, please come on back up. I didn't mean to kick you out. I said step back. I didn't mean the other end of the capital. JL, we're interested in maybe discussing how this would be targeted amongst industry and sectors and some limits and how the credit would be administered. I would like to have an ongoing discussion amongst the business community as to what kind of target industries you would consider, and I think JL, it's important that you be at the table because you represent a number of very small businesses, folks that run anywhere from, equipment would be something from a computer and a copier down to a pencil sharpener at some point. But I'm interested and anxious. And at the other end, you've got the folks that could be putting in enormous presses, chip presses that would be, $1 million a throw. So I'm looking for a balance there and a target for a sector and industries that could use this, and would use it as an attempt to expand and grow. I want investment in the equipment, obviously, and we'd want investment in new jobs and in jobs that would pay family wage and retain the jobs within those industry sectors. So if other questions of any member of the committee, I'm Representative or Lynn, I'm going to ask you to work with JL to see if you can't come up and work with Lisbeth, see if you can't come up with some method whereby we can target this to get the maximum amount of good out of it at what levels. I'm very anxious that we don't break the bank either, the upper limits there. So with that, if you'll work on this together, I would appreciate it. Representative Oakquist.
Just for the record, JL stepped out. Mr. Chair, JL, both the Farm Bureau raised the idea of front loading at 10%, not 2.5%. And then we asked Lynn to comment. Lynn gave us a good former speaker answer. Certainly sounds good, but didn't commit one way or the other. And the number that the Farm Bureau threw out just as an example was 10%. What's your reaction to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Boquist. To me, if you're working with a $30 million cap, as I presume we are, I would expend that $30 million this biennium, in the closest biennium, for the purposes of accelerating the economy now. And so I would work that percentage up as high. This is just if I were king for a day. I would also, you know, Lynn and I aren't scripted, but I would tend to skew it to smaller companies. That is, I don't think $1,000 makes a difference to Nike, and so I wouldn't even use that tax expenditure on a company that's going to make that decision with or without the $1,000. I think that probably could be used in a smaller company. The definition of a small business, for better or worse, in Oregon is 50 employees or less. You can talk about an employee threshold, but from our point of view, I would front load that for quicker acceleration now. Getting the job creation now is what I think we should be most concerned with.
Any reaction to the smaller versus the larger companies, Representative Riley?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I absolutely agree that we should be targeting those small companies, and whether we use that definition that we've used in other areas of 50 employees or not. Since the federal, I believe, is 500 employees, somewhere in between those two might be a good spot.
But excluding someone with less than 10 employees?
No.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say that I think 50 is a little low, but I don't know what the optimal is.
100 or below.
And I'd like to figure out a way to sort of target the manufacturing sector here, but I'm not sure how to do that.
Well, there are some folks in the room that I think can work that out.
Well, probably. I just, you know, I don't know that we're making this harder than it needs to be by trying to get too strategic here. We want the investment in new equipment. The more prescribed you get in what then you have fewer who take the offer, and then your benefit goes away. So I'm so open to suggestion, Mr. Chair, but I just would say that I think 50 is too small, JL.
Let's see, the federal small business definition was 500 or less. Is that what we said?
That's Mr. Chair, that's correct, and that encompasses 99.999% of Oregon employers.
Yeah.
Even at 50 employees, you're still looking at well in excess of 90% of Oregon employers.
Okay. Well, I'm going to defer that to you folks, but I would like to have you kind of strategically look at this and see what, and then perhaps work with Elizabeth to see if we can target that and get the front-end loading that would give us the maximum amount of benefit back in terms of investments and property, plant, equipment, and then the jobs, the family wage jobs that we're looking for. Other questions, observations? Representative Kahn?
I would just throw my 2 cents in, because at the salary we're making, that's all I have. But I'm sorry, you guys didn't laugh.
It's so tragic.
Small businesses really are the backbone of Oregon, and I that's just who a number of us represent, and I would like that to be one of the strongest considerations.
Thank you, Representative Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, just when we looked at this bill, there were some key things that I thought we ought to look at. One was small business. Another one was to make the percentage large enough to actually make the investment incentive there. Mm-hmm. Third was to have the amount that could be credited small enough so that you can spread it across, since we had $30 million fixed impact. Those were the key things that drove us. And the reason, I mean, a lot of people think of OBA as maybe just simply a big business. It's not. We have some very large businesses. We have members and brothers in Druzy and you know, Flush and other places that the chairman knows about. And so it's not that we are here. We're not here today trying to portray something for the benefit of Nike and Columbia Sports.
Good. Thank you very much. Lynn, if you'll work with the other, with JL and other of the business representatives, I would appreciate just hearing back from you in a couple of weeks, if we could, maybe a week or 10 days a meeting, and then just kind of see where we're heading at that point, what kinds of ideas and what kind of thoughts that we have to try and target this to make the maximum out of it. Other questions or observations, members of the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. We will close then the public hearing on 3355. And I will open a, colleagues, we have House Bill 3232 and 3233, both of them dealing with research and development expense credits. I want to see the number of sign-ups, if any. I think what we'll do is we're just going to go ahead and open a hearing on both House Bills 3232 and 3233. And Elizabeth, if you'll take us through those two bills. Thank you.
So, Chairman Butler, with House Bill 3232, this is similar to the other bill that we have already seen on R&D, the Research and Development Credit, House Bill 2368. But this is increasing that maximum annual cap on research and development credit to $1 million. So this is just going up to $1 million. The other bill went up to $2 million. And then these are just changes that are beginning tax year 2008. So it's a pretty straightforward bill. I also wanted to just draw your attention to the fact that the last time we talked about research and development credit, you asked me about giving you some additional information on the state survey, so I gave you, again, the state survey of research and development tax credits. I added then a column for the R&D credit percentage and the R&D credit carry forward, the number of years. And that was getting at really the last bill that we had dealing with R&D, but at least you get a little better sense of what's out there in other states and what they're doing. So, and the other thing I gave you was because you asked also about R&D, Chairman Butler, about the types of expenditures and
yes,
things.
Where the money went.
Yeah, and so I was quite surprised that I found a study out there on the effectiveness of research and experimentation tax credits, and this was in a federal study, but it's actually quite good, and it gave some really nice tables. And so I've given you a few tables there. It's a history of the R&D tax treatment in the United States and the federal law. And then it goes on and talks about real R&D expenditures in the U.S. But the one that I thought you'd be find helpful is really the last page, the distribution of qualified research expenditures for the R&D tax credit for 1992. And at least there it shows you, you know, out of the total qualified research in 1992, 62% of that was for wages. And so that really kind of shows you that the majority of it was for qualified researchers for their wages. Supplies, you can see there was 19.8%. 65% of contract research, basically how much did they contract out, and that was 12%.
So that would be, in effect, compensation page which would be in addition to 62%.
Right, and that really should be added into wages if you're thinking about in terms of labor. And then rental and lease of cost of computers, that was pretty small, and so was just the basic research payments to qualified organizations. So you can get a little bit of a sense there anyway, because we don't at the state level at all have any reports or anything on how this how our R&D tax credit is actually utilized by the companies that claim it. There have been a few audits and stuff done, but basically with R&D, it's not something that at the state level we have much expertise to really go in there and audit companies and get a sense of how well they are portraying their research. So that's just something that at the federal level they have much better auditing capability. So Department of Revenue really relies on the federal government to audit corporations with their R&D, because it's really now that we're based the research expenditures are based on the federal definitions,
right,
and stuff, then they really have good experts in there to be able to evaluate whether or not that research is qualified research.
Well, this is to me this is really eye-opening, because I would have figured that some of it, some significant portion would have gone back into hardware, machinery and equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And the indication is that less than 1% goes toward payments on machinery and equipment, unless you consider operating supplies up there, which is nearly 20%.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to guess that the difference between the 94.7% and 100% must be overhead of some sort, because the federal formula prescribes that there will be overhead, that there can be overhead applied to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the operating supplies is the supplies is kind of unique. But I guess this demonstrates that 74%+, and that's a number that I was looking for, 74%+ goes back into wages and compensation, which is what you're attempting to do, is to try and enhance the wage issues. So thank you very much for that research.
And did you want me to talk about the other bill? Are we going to have them speak on both of them?
Yeah, okay. Any questions on both of them at that point?
Yeah. So basically with House Bill 3233, and I don't have a revenue impact statement for either one of these, and that's just because we will bring these back again at the same time we have House Bill of the 2368, the other R&D credit, and we'll evaluate them all with the Oregon Tax Incident Model, and then I think it'll be less confusing to have static numbers and then have dynamic numbers added.
2368 is the other R&D.
Yeah, 2368 is the other one we've already heard. So then with House Bill 3233, this is allowing corporations which are eligible then to claim an R&D tax credit but have insufficient tax liability to sell the tax credit. So it's specifying that any compensation received from selling an R&D tax credit to be used to pay for future research and development expenses. So there is some strings attached to receiving a compensation, as you have to then turn around and reinvest in R&D expenses as far as that compensation. It requires a taxpayer who chooses to sell their R&D tax credit to file with the Department of Revenue. Then it provides rulemaking authority to the Department of Revenue to evaluate credit sale application. It is also mandating that if a sale of the tax credit is to occur, the amount of the compensation must equal at least 75% of the amount of the tax credit. So they can't sell the tax credit for nothing. They've got to sell it for at least 75% of that tax credit value. Also, the corporation purchasing the tax credit cannot own or control 5% or more of the corporation selling the tax credit, so there can't be a linkage between the corporations buying and selling the tax credit. The tax credit also has no positive impact or no positive income for the past 2 years. So you basically have to show that you can't use your tax credit in order to be able to sell it. Also, the taxpayer's operating revenue divided by their operating expenses results in a ratio of less than 110 for the past 2 years. And then the final one is just that taxpayer cannot be part of a consolidated group of affiliated corporations that in the aggregate have positive income. So you're basically going to have these tests to determine whether or not the corporation has no tax liability and therefore wouldn't be able to use their tax credit, so then they're allowed the opportunity to sell them. It's limiting the total amount of sale of research and development credits to $40 million per year. So again, this is another one of those where Department of Revenue would have to be evaluating what's the total amount that would be sold and then only going up to a $40 million cap per year. It allows a taxpayer who purchased the research and development credit to amend their corporate tax returns for 6 months to claim the tax credit in its beginning tax years on or after 2006. And just so everyone remembers, this research and development credit has, for the past couple of years from our data, has had quite a bit of outstanding corporate tax liability, unused corporate tax liability. So this really is targeting those corporations that have quite a bit of unused research and development credits. Plus, as we've discussed before, we've been broadening the base now in the future due to our bill last session. So the use of the research and development credit is bound to grow, and so we will see, more unused R&D credits. And so that's the premise, basically, for this bill.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Are there questions of staff relative to 3232 or 3233, the research and development? Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elizabeth, the 3233, do you see any compliance issues there? isn't it pretty hard to determine all those connectivities in companies, and how are you going to, how is that going to be done? Isn't that pretty expensive we're talking about?
Chairman Butler and Representative Riley, yeah, that really is a Department of Revenue kind of question, and I don't know that they've done a fiscal or anything on the bill itself. But, yes, I think that there are going to be additional auditing, basically, and trying to make sure that they meet all these various thresholds that are in the bill, and it might be quite difficult. So, yeah, it's something Deborah Buchanan could probably speak to better.
There are difficulties there, Representative Riley, and that would be a fatal defect in part of this. So that's a good catch. Representative Hass is recognized.
Technical question along the same lines about the mechanics of selling these. Who looks out for the way money changes hands, and just how carefully is that tracked?
Chairman Butler and Representative Hass, it seems like the Department of Revenue, you know, has to first get each time they're going to sell that credit. So if they want to sell it, they have to, the purchaser and the seller have to agree, and then that all has to be reported to the Department of Revenue. So that's really, Department of Revenue is the one who has the authority to really be tracking all that. Plus, they have to make sure they're not allocating more credits than $40 million per year as far as the amount that could be sold.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? Thank you very much, Elizabeth. We'll go ahead and merge those two bills with our other R&D tax credit bills, and when we bring back the tax credit bill for final opportunity to take a look at it, we'll address that again at that time. With that, if there's no further questions about 3232 or 3233, we'll close the public hearing. Thank you. No one had signed up for either of those two bills. Riveting subject. Colleagues, we're set up for a work session, and I'm going to go ahead and gavel open a work session on House Bill 2629. Let's see. Yeah, that's probably the best place to start, is just because we also have language for bill proposal for committee introduction of additional bills that need to be introduced on behalf of committee, and we'll do that while we're in work session. Right now we're on work session on 2629. Let's go ahead into that, and we'll come back to the other two issues there. Let me preface the remarks by saying that Representatives Riley and Boquist have been working on this issue now for the past week or 10 days, sorting through a number of pretty exhaustive schedules, and we appreciate your work. And colleagues, no matter how this issue turns out, we want to recognize your good work and your diligence and staying after these issues. This is not easy work. It's tedious, and it takes some stomach lining off each time that you open it up and work on it. So I do appreciate the rather extensive work of committee members and your willingness to accept these kind of assignments. So with that, Elizabeth, would you bring us up to date to where we're at on 2629?
Chairman Butler, you have two amendments in front of you, a -1 and a -2. So I'll just go through them. Basically, the -1 is the same as what we talked about yesterday. This is Representative Riley had worked on this amendment. So this is increasing the gross estate value filing threshold for Oregon estate tax purposes to $2 million in tax year 2007 and beyond. So it just goes up to $2 million, doesn't go beyond $2 million. It adopts a new Oregon estate tax rate schedule with estate tax rates increasing from 0 to 22.7% for the taxable estate value in excess of $2 million. So basically, if you look on the third page of the his -1 amendment, that's where you see the new tax schedule. So basically, again, it's this new tax, estate tax will be on the amount of taxable value that's above the threshold amount. So in this case, it's $2 million. So it's the amount that's above that is what you're going to apply these tax rates of 0 up to 22.7%. Now, the way this was run, or the schedule was run, it's smoothing out those tax state taxes, but also it is increasing the amount of tax on the higher estates than what they would have been paying under current law. And then that is the revenue that is generated from that is equivalent to the amount of revenue loss that you get when you go from $1 million filing threshold up to the $2 million filing threshold. So basically, with the Dash 1 amendment, it's revenue neutral as far as overall for the future bienniums. And basically, some estates will have a lower tax estate tax, those that are near the filing threshold, but those above out in the larger estates would have an increase in their Oregon estate tax. So even though overall the state revenue is revenue neutral, there will be differences within the estates themselves from the new tax rate schedule. But it does smooth it out, makes it more progressive, and that's what you're getting there, going from 0 to 22.7%.
So under this method, the $10 million estate would pay $1,419,500,
mm-hmm.
And a $2 million estate would pay zero.
Right.
The rates then have gone from above $2 million, from 5% up to 22.4% at that particular point, and then mm-hmm. on the first dollar above $10 million, then they will pay, well, let's see, I guess it's $9
million
at 1,419,500, because at $10 million I would pay $1,643,500.
That's right.
Okay. And then beyond that, then my rate for the first dollar above $10 million becomes 22.7% on that first dollar.
That's right.
Okay. Any questions about both the smoothing and the top-end increase under the Dash 1 amendment? Okay.
And let me just address one issue that's consistent with both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2, in the sense that they're kind of silent on the issue of we're attaching now to the federal definition of taxable estate value. That is something that under federal law you're allowed a deduction for your state estate taxes that you pay. So what Department of Revenue has brought forward is that we haven't really addressed in the bill yet whether or not you should be allowed a deduction for estate taxes in Oregon at your federal return, because by allowing that deduction, you can't then determine what your estate tax would be in Oregon. So basically, I think what they would do without additional language would just be to not allow an estate tax deduction here in Oregon.
Of course, that's a federal issue, isn't it?
For determining your federal taxes, mm-hmm. you would mm-hmm. be allowed that
a deduction from
the state.
Right.
But then here in Oregon, you would not be allowed that same estate.
Right.
In keeping with the
existing law that does not allow the Chapter 1 taxes to be deductible, then what happens is that the tax would have to be added back to the estate taxable estate value for Oregon. That's merely a rules process that is silent in that regard.
So everyone's clear, that is something that isn't in the bill. And the other thing with Representative Riley's amendment is that in the future, in 2009, you know that the federal is going to go to $3.5 million as far as the filing threshold. During that year, then we would have this, because we're deleting the language in here in page 4 about making a separate election in Oregon that's different from the federal. And as we had the bill that Representative Hass is carrying soon, House Bill 2452, That bill basically, you know, was allowing, broadening the number of estates and stuff that could actually have a special separate election here in Oregon. So this is, in 2009, then you would have this disconnect again with federal law. And
after 2009.
After 2009 and beyond. So
that would be something you wouldn't be allowing a separate election to allow spouses then to have that, estate tax be paid at the death of the second spouse, the surviving spouse. So that's just something that, if you want to deal with that in the future, you can, or it can come forward in a future bienniums. I mean, you just don't know what the federal government's going to do either with the state taxes. So anyway, that's just one component of the dash one versus the dash two. If you want me to
please
go to that, I'll go
two.
To dash two now. But the dash two, we're completely conforming Oregon's estate tax filing threshold to the federal estate tax filing threshold beginning in 2007, but then we do, again, we start at $2 million for tax years 2007 and 8, but then in tax year 09, we go up to the $3.5 million filing threshold, the same as federal law, so then you don't need this special election, again, in Oregon to compensate for the difference between the filing thresholds. So basically with the Dash 2 amendment, you also are establishing a new Oregon estate tax rate schedule. So again, you can look on about the third page here. And basically that shows you the new estate tax rate schedule. It's going, and again, this is on the taxable estate value that's above the threshold. So it's for the value above $2 million. For tax years 2007 and 2008, you're going to go from 0 up to 16%, but it would not go beyond 16%. So that's basically the difference there in the tax rate schedule. So you have, again, the smoothing. The lower estates are going to have a reduction in their estate taxes that then doesn't get compensated at the higher end like you have in the Dash 1 amendment. And then in the in tax year 2009 and beyond, you have the filing threshold of $3.5 million. Then, as you can see from page 4 there at the top here, now we're just going to be having a 16% tax rate for all of the taxable value that's in excess of $3.5 million for 2009 and beyond. So basically, it's a flat tax at 2009 and beyond for just the value that's above $3.5 million. So that's basically the way the new estate tax would work. And what you have in the Dash 2 amendment is you do have a revenue loss, and this consists of both increasing the filing threshold as well as changing that estate tax rate schedule. And in the 2007-09 biennium, it's a reduction of $33.7 million, and I have included in there some feedback effects, but you can see they're not real big as far as they're really only about less than 10% as far as a percent of the static impact.
Elizabeth, explain the feedback effects, if you would, please.
Yeah, so this is run from the Oregon Tax Incident Model, and it's looking at, okay, if you're going to reduce estate taxes by the amount that's listed here in 2007-08, basically what are going to be the positive effects, because now certain taxpayers are going to have more disposable income, then they can invest more, purchase more in the economy, and so it's looking at all the ripple effects, the multiplier effects that you hear about, that are going to be occurring in the economy from having certain taxpayers not have to pay such a high estate tax. So that's why they're positive there, they're positive of $1 million in the 2007-09 biennium. And then it's phased in over 5 years, so you don't see those. That's why you see these positive feedback effects growing. And then it grows up by 2009-11 up to $5
million. That's true. Representative Hass.
So, Elizabeth, just to elaborate then on the feedback effects, you're saying the model shows there isn't much in terms of reinvesting back into the economy.
Representative Hass, that's correct. This does not have as large an effect, and that's just because it's not targeting. When you're targeting a certain labor or you're targeting capital, then you're going to be seeing much more of dynamic feedback in the economy because the businesses are going to be directly impacted from having lower costs. But this is kind of an indirect effect because basically we're saying certain consumers are going to be able to spend more. So that spending has ripple effects, but it's not as large as if you're directly influencing a factor of production and lowering that cost and then seeing those ripple effects from the additional lowering of costs there for businesses.
Any attempt to try and capture those the states that would flee out of Oregon because of lesser tax rates or connection in the adjacent states to the federal tax exemption?
Chairman Butler, no, I have not tried to capture that. It would be pretty difficult.
Okay. Representative Bradley.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Amendment 1. And I'd like to discuss that, if I may.
Representative Riley moves the Dash 1 amendments to your motion, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I appreciate your putting us on this detail and going after this revenue-neutral version, and I hope that, Mr. Chair, that you will go along with this revenue-neutral one that I've come up with, that actually... staff has come up with, and I appreciate her work as well. Basically, I believe that it's a good thing to raise the threshold to get those small estates out of this tax problem, and I think that this does that just as we stated we should. This bill has the advantage of not chipping away at our school year at this, and this is a good thing. We keep this revenue neutral. We can actually not lose revenue, and we can help those folks that we need to help. And I would hope that you would all vote for this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Riley. So Representative Riley's motion relative to Dash 1 would be to use the $2 million exemption beginning in the year 2007 and beyond, and does not contemplate the $3.5 million federal exclusion in later years.
We don't know what the feds are going to do, Mr. Chair, and so I just wanted to take care of the next biennium and see where we go after that.
Thank you. Further discussion relative to Representative Riley's motion. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to first thank Representative Riley because we both worked on this and we even got confused at times. And he was in my shoes and I was in his shoes. And I'll just leave it at that at one point. And I'd like to thank Liz Beth for, because I think, I know in my case, I was confused multiple times and had to come ask to be rescued. And I understand the point that Representative Riley is raising, and unfortunately, obviously, I'll vote against the amendment, and that comes back to, I mean, for 6 years, I've actually run on the total elimination of the estate tax, mm-hmm. and specifically would be interested in phasing out so on and so forth, but cannot vote to increase the estate tax, at least to for the threshold up. And as you well know, Mr. Chairman, at several points, we looked at even models that went above 16% to see what the effects were back and forth. But I simply am not going to be able to support an amendment that top ends, because it's not really a 22% at the end. Because remember, in both amendments, members of the committee were eliminating the tax below the threshold. Presently, you're penalized in the state of Oregon once you cross $1 over that threshold. And so while the models themselves, show smaller increases, for example, in this case, the amendment 22% going up, the actual impact is sometimes different. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Boquist. Further discussion relative to the motion to move the Dash 1 amendments. The motion now is to move, by Representative Riley, is to move the Dash 1 amendments to the estates for estates greater than $2 million beginning in 2007. Which would be then exempt in Oregon up to $2 million, but also smoothing and increasing the rates to a maximum of 22.7. Further discussion? Hearing and seeing none, we will call the roll. The question is to move the Dash 1 amendments. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed say no at the call.
Representative Boquist?
No.
Representative Esquivel?
No.
Representative Galizio.
Aye.
Representative Trump.
No.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
No.
Vice Chair Hass.
Yes.
Chair Butler.
Butler votes no. The motion to move dash one fails. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash two amendment.
Representative Boquist moves dash two amendment to House Bill 2629, dated 3/28/05. To your amendment, Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, the original bill we're amending is a bill I sponsored, so there shouldn't be a whole lot of surprise in this. And again, I want to thank Representative Riley for all the work that we did together, so on and so forth like that. In my district, as I said earlier, I mean, 3/4 of the constituents in my district would like to see the state tax completely eliminated. And I'm familiar with a whole broad area, at least 1/5 of the size of the state of Oregon, since I ran for Congress twice. And my good opponent, Congressman Darlene Cooley, whipped me both times. Yet she supported the federal tax code and the federal estate tax, which is moving to $2.2 million, as we're proposing here, in $3.5 million. And the goal here that we're trying to do is to help the small businesses that are property-based, so that they can hand it from family to family. And we're talking about businesses like they're down in Coos Bay and fishing industry, you know, small areas like that. We're talking about nurseries that are growing in Marion County and that area, and even the types of businesses that are out in Washington County that we all kind of talked about and be around. There are 31 states that are doing pretty much the same thing of what we're proposing here. And while it's revenue neutral in 05, 07, it does, you know, obviously have a fiscal impact, and it's my belief that through the economy and other reasons, we're going to grow into those challenges that we have in 07 and in 09. And I think regardless of whether we can identify it or not, there is a state flight. And so here we're in a position of not knowing how to identify it, but this is another step in the direction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion relative to the motion. Representative Hass is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too want to thank Representatives Boquist and Riley for getting together and working on this stuff. It is very complicated. But when I look at this and some of the research that the staff has provided, this is a benefit. This is a tax cut, effectively, for the top 1% of the families in Oregon. And it just baffles me that of all the problems facing this state, that this is the one we choose to focus on, and this is the group of people that we chosen to help. I just don't understand it, especially after the discussion we had today, a thoughtful discussion about what's best, how we could spend money in a targeted, focused way that pays dividends like it's an investment, how after that discussion we could vote to give a tax cut to the top 1% of Oregon families. It baffles me.
Further baffling? Questions?
Yeah, I mean, I can't sit still here and not echo some of what, and just include, I thought there was really excellent testimony where people were talking about the impact this could have on charitable giving and for nonprofits. And here we are, we're going to have difficulty trying to cover essential services for schools, human services, public safety. And yes, if we have some kind of targeted effect, but there is been no evidence that this has any kind of a sort of investment stimulus. And I just feel it's frustrating that I thought Representative Riley's amendment, we had this fantastic opportunity to recognize the changes that needed to be made, yet remaining revenue neutral, and we passed that up. So I think the dash two amendment is just not in Oregon's best interest.
Thank you, Representative Galizio. Further comments or questions? Colleagues, I'm going to, at the risk of saying it wrong, I'm going to repeat something that I heard just recently over this past opportunity that I had to be back in my district. Like some of you, I live in a border district that borders on another state, the state of Idaho, which represents the federal $2 million exemption and the $3.5 million upcoming exemption. I also recognize that the state of Washington, as a result of the Hemphill decision in the Supreme Court, is totally without today, is totally without any death tax. And the figure that was given to me while I was away and out of town this past weekend, 13 of the last 14 major sales of automobile dealerships, of Oregon automobile dealerships, have closed and settled for those large family, long-term owned family automobile dealerships, have closed with the residents, owners of the automobile dealerships, having left the state of Oregon in not less than just a few months prior to the close of the sale. These are multi-million dollar sales. They're occurring out of the state of Oregon with Oregon businesses that have accumulated. Now, we will never see the return of those folks with their ordinary income back to the state of Oregon. And I give that as just a portion of the evidence, and I became acutely aware of this when I went to a couple of different brokerage firms in Portland last summer, and I was told that, in somewhat jocular terms, that many of the major earning families in the state of Oregon had moved their homes, their residences, out of the state of Oregon to escape both income and death taxes. At that time, the state of Washington was treating the death tax much like we had prior to our amendments to it in 2003. So I'm going to say that I think that this is a responsible thing for us to do, to be proactive. The other thing I'm going to say, and I'm going on a little bit of a limb here too, and that is this: that when we take into consideration the size of the amount or the size of the pie that we're talking about, these calculations have been based upon estates not growing very rapidly in the state of Oregon. And when we have 20% increases in the value of real property in the Portland metropolitan area in 1 year, I'm going to tell you that the estates in this state are going to increase fairly rapidly, and that the state will do just fine in future years. We've collected $132 million, or we're anticipating a collection through June 30 of $132 million of death tax. I think we will meet that, but the projections to have smaller amounts collected in the future, I think, are inappropriate. I think that we are going to actually expend and collect much larger amounts. Folks are going to expend more in writing their checks for these death taxes in the future. So I just need to comment to you that I think that unless we get ahead of this game, the wealth will leave the state of Oregon, and with it they will take the ordinary income tax, and they will take the opportunity for other estates to grow in the state of Oregon. So I am speaking in favor of the Dash 2 amendments. I think that it is a responsible thing to do. Representative Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly appreciate your fear that those things will come true. But the evidence just isn't there about the flight out of state. There is inconclusive evidence that it may be the other way around if you look at the demand for retirement housing in central Oregon, along the Oregon coast, and at the Population Bureau at Portland State University, that there is a lot of in-flight to Oregon from those who may not be billionaires, but who are wealthy and who are buying up these retirement properties. So while I appreciate your fear that this may be happening or could happen someday, it just isn't documented.
And I would counter that, Representative Hass, by saying that the fear, when the check is written to out of state residences, is reality. And my concern is that those folks that are coming to Oregon are in fact buying second residences and third residences. Oregon is not an uncommon state. We have a small home over near the Oregon coast between Yahats and Walport, and I can look across from where our home is and see several multi-million dollar residences, not one of which is owner-occupied. Not one of which is owner-occupied at this point. And colleagues, I guess what I'm saying is there are a lot of folks that are investing in property in the state of Oregon and driving some values up. My concern is that their estates will not be taxed in the state of Oregon. However, if they have a $2 million piece of property that piece of property will certainly be taxed as a part of the gross estate, and they may end up paying some death tax in the state of Oregon, but they are not coming to the state of Oregon to live. They're coming to the state of Oregon to enjoy it for a short period of time and leaving. And that's a concern. But I appreciate that Representative Hass that some of this is anecdotal. My concern is that we've got to send the correct message, particularly where the states which surround us have continued to do this and are fairly successful in their collections and their property value increases. So with that, the motion before us is to move the dash to amendments, and the motion is presented to us by Representative Volquist, and that is a combination of a $2.0 million exclusion for years 2007 and 2008, and 2009 and beyond, a $3.5 million increase with tax rates beginning as low as 4% and going to a maximum of 16% on the marginal amount. Those in favor of the motion will vote aye. Those in opposition, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Volquist.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Delizio.
No.
Representative Trump.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
No.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hass.
No.
Chair Butler.
Butler votes aye. With that, we will append the dash 2 to 26-29. Representative Hass?
Yep.
Okay. And we will ask that House Bill 2629, as A engrossed, will move to the full House with the due pass recommendation. The motion is that, made by Representative Boquist, 2629, as A engrossed, with the dash 2 amendments under date of March 2805, moved to the full House and do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection. Let's have the clerk call a roll again. Those in favor of moving 2629 as A engrossed with the dash 2 amendments, vote aye. Those in opposition, no. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Boquist.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Galizio.
No.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
No.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hass.
Hass votes no. Serves possible motives of the possible minority
Chair,
report.
Chair Butler.
Butler votes aye. With that, colleagues, we will move House Bill 2629. The motion passes. 2629 moves to the full House floor with a due pass recommendation. Be it noted for the record that Representative Hass serves notice of possible minority report. Further discussion? We will close the work session. We'll continue this. We'll close the work session on 2629, and we will open a work session on draft bills. The House rules require that bill drafts requests after the House deadline must come through the committee and through the Speaker's office. I will move that the committee request four bill drafts needed to complete the work complete our work plan. If the Speaker approves this request, the LCs will come back to the committee for introduction at a later date. Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. We will go ahead and request that. And the carrier for 2629 is Representative Boquist. Well, thank you for reminding me of that. I was told that if we forgot the name, then it became the chair, and I don't want to do that. So Representative Boquist will carry 2629. And is there any further discussion or business to the committee at this time? Hearing and seeing none, we will go ahead and close the day. Thank you very much for a spirited conversation and discussion today.